Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Taser International, the sole manufacturer of the tasers used by police departments in the United States, consistently claims that its products are non-lethal, despite the fact that there have been many reported taser-related deaths in this country. A documentary by Nick Berardini called Killing Them Safely looks into how tasers have changed policing practices since they were introduced and tries to determine who's responsible for a taser-related death when police officers are repeatedly told that they do no harm. The film opens at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village this Friday, and it'll also be available on VOD. I'm very pleased that it has brought Nick Berardini to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thank you for having me.
One of the subjects in your film is a man named Stanley Harlan of Moberly, Missouri. How did you learn about him?
Yeah, Stanley Harlan's case came to me as I was finishing my undergraduate degree at the University of Missouri. I happened to be a student reporter working for the NBC affiliate in town the night he died, and just like raced out there in the middle of the night, coincidentally, and stuck with that story as I was finishing up my coursework throughout the year and didn't have, you know, a real driving interest to go into TV news. I had assumed that I always wanted to be in filmmaking, and this presented itself to be an opportunity to make a film about this small town that had really become fractured over what happened. I had no idea that it would spiral into the behemoth that it eventually became, but that was really the genesis for the film.
Did Stanley Harlan display any sort of threatening behavior toward the police that night?
No, that's really what started to pique my curiosity toward the company. Even by the time that the criminal investigation was closed, what the special prosecutor had said was that there was no evidence in the training material of the officers that what happened to him could be possible. And there was really no dispute that what happened to him was that he was tasered in the chest for 31 seconds and died of cardiac arrest. I mean, everybody was pretty much on the same page about that. And so as I got more into their training, and as the officers during the civil case were deposed and admitted that he posed no physical threat, the question of, you know, how could this happen to somebody, what's the disconnect there, started to make me more curious about the only company really selling and training officers on how to use them.
How long have tasers been available to police departments?
They have been around in some fashion for roughly 40 years now. Jack Cover, the original inventor, was relatively unsuccessful, though, at selling them to departments for two big reasons. One was that they used to be fired by gunpowder, so they were regulated by the ATF as a firearm. And the other was that they just weren't practically that effective, especially against the very people it was idealistically going to be used on, the aggressive, motivated, violent offenders. And what the Smith brothers did, Rick and Tom Smith, who were the two founding brothers of Taser International, was they figured out a way to increase the power of the weapons to make them effective, and they did that sort of while facing bankruptcy. And I don't want to give too much of the film away, but you know, there clearly are some hypothetical consequences with that when they made that decision that they didn't think through.
Now, the original was called an air taser. Does that name really describe what goes on here? Isn't it designed to give an electric shock?
Yeah, it was initially called an air taser because the Smith brothers were the first ones who were able to figure out how to use compressed nitrogen to fire the weapons as opposed to gunpowder, and that allowed them to get away from ATF regulation. But it does deliver electric current through wires that shoot out of the weapon and attach into the body, and that's where the conducted electricity comes through. So air tasers maybe a little misleading, but now they are commonly referred to either as the X26 or the X2, which is the newer model that has a backup shot along with it.
And they have increased power. So they're sending a lot of electricity into our bodies, and that's designed to kind of paralyze us for a moment?
Yeah, the idea, you know, and why the film is so interesting is because it's not really a clean-cut case of good guys and bad guys. I mean, their intentions in the beginning might have been altruistic. I would allow them that, you know, point of view. But what we watch is as they evolve over the course of, you know, more than a decade. And in the wake of this collateral damage, what you're seeing is they didn't really know how to manage the effectiveness of the weapon because nobody really understands how electricity works underneath the skin. The two leading regulatory agencies for electricity, the Underwriters Lab and the International Electrotechnical Commission, don't really understand how it works. And because of that, it was more a game of not if the taser could kill people, but how often it would kill people. And that's what really became tragic as you watch the film evolve, is we're sort of turning this into then a cost-benefit analysis while forgetting that ultimately there are a lot of dead people who die in situations they shouldn't be put in jeopardy in because officers believe that the weapons can't kill.
How many people have died as a result?
Well, you know, again, that's part of the problem of use of force statistics in the United States is we don't really keep an accurate record. But estimates are now showing that it's up over 900 people in North America.
Wow.
And the problem with that also is in each case, it's difficult sometimes to determine because electricity doesn't leave the consistent biomarkers in an autopsy that, you know, a gunshot might, for example, or an electrocution, which would leave burns. These are not people who are dying from electrocution. These are often people who are either dying from metabolic acidosis because the weapon causes 19 muscle contractions a second. So over the course of 30 or 40 seconds of being tasered, your blood can become acidic. Or they're dying of ventricular fibrillation, which is essentially a cardiac arrest that is difficult to determine if the electricity itself is the cause.
And we've seen this happening here as well. A man in the Bronx died of cardiac arrest after he'd been shocked by a taser.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Well, I think that what's important to know is that the company, you know, is where the movie is so interesting and where dealing with them was so interesting is that their rhetoric is fascinating. I mean, this is a company that has perfected marketing and rhetoric, knowing that all they had to do was plant the idea that it was a debate, even though their own internal research is showing that these risks are you know, borne out into the field. All they had to do was plant the idea to the officer in training that it was a debate. And if the officers had loyalty to Taser International, because Taser International was so effective at marketing to them, at saying, we're on your side, the public is not on your side, they would tend to believe the company. They don't want to believe this company with a mission statement to protect truth and protect life is coming in there and misleading them.
And they claim that they've helped save up to 90,000 lives. So by comparison, those 900 lives seem relatively small.
Exactly, and that 90,000 lives number is patently absurd. I mean, you know, it's made up, basically. We look at in-custody deaths, and the estimates show about 1,500 people a year total die, including shootings. So that would mean before they were in business, we were looking at, you know, 15,000 people a year or something that were dying, because now they claim the number is up over 150,000 people. But it's something that sounds like it might be true, and so that's what the officers respond to. And there's not a lot of concrete data because, again, we don't keep track of use of force that can counter that. And that's the danger of one company controlling this message to law enforcement officers.
I'm speaking to Nick Berardini, the director of Killing Them Safely, which opens at the IFC Center, also will be available on video on demand this coming Friday. Well, didn't they test it before they sent it to market?
Unfortunately, no.
They tested it on themselves and on their families.
Right, and this is where the disconnect really comes into play. In training, and they trumpet this a lot, no one has ever died during a training exercise using a taser. But the training is specifically designed to be as safe as possible. You know, naturally, that's the way it works with anything. So
it's meant to be a compliance tool.
Right. What happens is that they take these officers in training, they shoot them in the back, oftentimes for less than 5 seconds, and that way they can experience the pain of it and how it feels. But there are no restrictions that are required, that are, you know, that are actually put in. It's up to the departments to write their own policies with tasers information that they're giving them. And so there are no real restrictions usually about how often somebody can be tasered. So the training experience is completely different than the way the weapons are used in the field. And it's those extended durations that for a very long time, you know, only in the past few years have really been warned about, but for a very long time were never even acknowledged or warned about the risks of those, you know, extended durations, which can be very dangerous.
In counties where police are also armed with tasers, does it make it less likely that a police officer will use a gun?
No, you know, what was important for us was to not necessarily, I wanted to make this movie about the men behind the decisions and not just a debate about how to use tasers. So we don't get too far into this, but quite honestly, I've never seen any research over an extended period of time that shows a significant reduction in deadly force with officers who use tasers. Now, what the company will claim is that injuries to suspects and to officers go down. And the injuries to officers definitely do go down, but that's because they're using them more frequently than anything else, and they're standing oftentimes at a 15-foot distance. Injuries to suspects is a bit misleading because we're not having to record or report the electricity going through the body as an injury. So even though it's very painful, there's no injury reporting requirement there oftentimes with departments. And that can be very misleading. In terms of deadly force, a lot of really good newspaper investigative journalists have tracked that, you know, for several different papers, and none that I've ever seen has shown that the deadly force actually goes down.
How did the police officers you talked to feel about tasers?
Many of them are conflicted. A number of them are very, very loyal. And the company, you know, at this point, this movie is sort of about how the victors write their own history, because tasers are not coming back en masse. And I think that would be a mistake to bring them back en masse, because so many officers are trained on these weapons and they've become somewhat reliant on these weapons. But the officers who have some bad experiences with them, whether that's someone who's severely injured, sometimes it's an officer in training who's injured, or, you know, they kill somebody in the field with them. The tragedy of this is that by the time anybody realizes what the actual consequences might be, it's too late. Someone is already injured or killed, and then we're retroactively sort of rewriting policies or rethinking the weapon's use in those individual departments. And I don't think that's the way it should be, obviously. The point of the film is, if anything, just to raise awareness with officers, to show them we're being thoughtful about your job and what it takes to do your job. Try to be thoughtful about not just what you're dealing with, but who you're dealing with, the men that are actually selling you this weapon.
Didn't the price of taser stocks shoot up in the wake of the Baltimore riots?
Yes. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they're the market leader in body cameras now. And while body cameras aren't weapons, they're using the same rhetoric to sell body cameras that they sold tasers with. And that is essentially that the public is against you. The public, you know, will make these frivolous claims. They will try to, you know, claim excessive force. They will try to trap you. Buy these body cameras to protect yourselves. And practically speaking, the departments respond to it because they want to look proactive to, you know, public strife. They want their, you know, citizens to think they're doing something proactive. But it helps deepen the divide that exists between between police officers and the communities they serve. All the while, this company is a weapons manufacturer. They have a vested interest in making sure that they are prioritized first. And what we don't know about body cameras yet, despite the rush to sort of put them on all these police officers, is how they're going to be stored, because Taser International controls a lot of the storage, and there's a significant upcharge for that. And who has access to that footage? That's something that really hasn't been thought out or borne out yet, but we're seeing this rush to put body cameras on officers in order to quell sort of public strife about use of force, and yet we don't have the practicality quite figured out yet.
Taser International announced today that it won a contract to outfit the London Metropolitan Police Force with body cameras. Now, you've written that our discussions about policing are failing in the United States. What's mm-hmm. been wrong about the discussions?
I think it becomes too easy to simplify a use of force scenario in order to use it as evidence. And what we do is we take the sort of last 30 seconds of somebody's life and an officer's decision making and essentially use it to either mark the, you know, check the box of those who are defenders of law enforcement or those who would be critical of law enforcement. And the problem with that is that very few instances obviously are black and white. Many of them can be interpreted subjectively. And so what happens is now we're into this sort of shouting match, and the problem with that is that the officers then feel like the public doesn't understand their job, and the public doesn't, you know, feels that the officers or the departments are not responding and engaging, you know, in a way that's designed to protect people's lives. And so I think what we need to do is have a bit more of an evolved discussion about why this strife exists in the first place. How do we make departments more transparent? How do we make officers feel like the authority that we give them to use force is a responsibility, but one that we accept, one that we know has to be taken seriously? And I think that's critical. Rather than instantly rushing to try to use these cases as evidence, we need to remember the humanity involved, definitely on both sides.
Now, in 2009, Taser International updated its training guides, saying that officers shouldn't aim for the chest. Where did they suggest they should aim for?
That's a good question. It's really about trying to figure out a way. This is part of the problem, is that these officers were trained to shoot center mass because that's the way they're trained on their guns. It was a seamless training. And the problem with that, of course, is that the danger that can exist when shooting someone in the chest is not really what the company is acknowledging. They're saying that to basically avoid liability while at the same time telling officers there's really still nothing to see here. It's just more about avoiding the controversy, as they put it. But what that does to the officer now is add a layer of decision-making that he has to make in the field. And what they end up doing sometimes is either aiming lower and missing or shooting people in the back, trying to get behind someone to shoot them in the back, which makes these weapons not really that effective for their intended purpose, which is a high-risk, volatile situation, you know, not necessarily where somebody is armed, but somebody is actively resisting and attacking, you know, the officers or someone else. If you're using the one-shot model, you can miss quite easily. And in fact, the police officers that we spoke to, when they were considering whether to keep tasers and just move them up the use of force continuum, decided ultimately that didn't make a lot of sense because 23% of the time they weren't getting the intended result they wanted, which meant that if they weren't going to be used in the high-risk scenarios, why justify the expense of buying them for all their street officers to begin with?
The Heston versus Taser case, which dealt with liability, was the first lawsuit that Taser International lost. What happened there?
Robert Heston, and now there's been several that they've lost or settled out of court, and you learn this sort of progression in the film. Everything that happens in the film is sort of an existential threat to the company because it's ultimately about the movies, the movie's about this company's sort of ability to try to justify its own existence. But starting with Heston, what we started to find in the public was that we could start identifying mechanisms of death. The company was very good, especially because the research was so sparse in the beginning, at sort of either feigning ignorance or downplaying what the mechanisms of death might be because they'd be difficult to determine. Heston was tasered for over a minute by three different officers and died of metabolic acidosis in combination with methamphetamine that he was on. So it was significant because the jury was saying, while we recognize that his drug use may have played a role in this death, the acidosis caused by the taser and caused by the pinning of the officers over that extended period of time also contributed to his death.
Well, does Taser International suggest that you taser somebody for a minute?
They do not suggest that, but they also don't restrict that. They want the officers to have to be able to make that judgment in the field as a part of a way to try to avoid liability. Again, companies, you know, have to protect themselves first, and that's one of the ways they can make sure they don't get sued. If they tell an officer he can only use it for 10 seconds in the field, and he uses it for 8 seconds, and the suspect gets up and hurts the officer, the company will get sued. So they've very surreptitiously tried to sort of acknowledge that, you know, acidosis might be a thing, but don't let that, you know, impair your judgment in the field. And they're doing that in order to avoid any potential liability.
Has anybody done a study to determine whether in counties or countries where taser use has been dropped significantly that there's been an increase in officer or suspect deaths?
Yeah, and we kind of outline this, again, as we go throughout the film, toward the end of the film. The one I can specifically cite, you know, for sure is a big, broad, you know, really, really broadly scoped research development is in British Columbia. The use of tasers drops by about 83% in British Columbia after a really tragic incident in the airport in Vancouver, and there was no rise in suspect or officer injuries. Everything pretty much, you know, essentially remained the status quo, except for the fact that they were having less significant, you know, high-profile controversial deaths. In other studies, what we've seen is that the first year departments use tasers, the in-custody deaths can go up by as much as 600%, and that's because they're so eager to use them. They're so eager to, you know, they're so enamored with what the taser can do that they use it at very low levels of force and in dangerous manners. Now, what happens is people die, and then they peel back, you know, how they're using them and rewrite policies. But that's what I think can be really dangerous, is that without understanding the consequences, you become enamored with the best version, the best idea of what this technology can do, without really understanding what the consequences are.
Nick, do you know about whether New York City is buying tasers?
Yeah, New York City is actually now again doubling down, and they're spending about $4.5 million on new tasers and body cameras in response to what we've seen with the Walter Scott shooting, with Freddie Gray, with a lot of these incidents, because it looks proactive. And the public's idea of this weapon is still that it is an alternative to deadly force. That's what the company has done very, very well in terms of marketing. They pitch it as an alternative to deadly force to the public. But to police officers, who are the ones who are really the only ones who matter, they are pitching it as a weapon that can be used to end all confrontations. And so the appearance of doing something about, again, doing something about the strife is, let's buy more tasers and body cameras, and now we'll reduce deadly force and we'll hold officers accountable for their actions. In practicality, that's not really how it plays out.
Nick Berardini's film, Killing Them Safely, opens this Friday at the IFC Center and also will be available on video on demand. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Although it's been 48 years since its original release, Don't Look Back, D.E. Pennybaker's chronicle of Bob Dylan's 1965 tour of England, still stands out as one of the most important pop music films ever made. And the version of Subterranean Homesick Blues, which we've been listening to, is presented in the film with Dylan dropping amusing cue cards as the song is played. It turns out that would be recognized later as one of the first ever music videos. To commemorate the 50th anniversary of that tour, his last solo acoustic tour, the Criterion Collection is re-releasing Don't Look Back on DVD and Blu-ray with digitally restored audio and video and a slew of special features, interviews, outtakes, and shorter documentaries. And I'm very pleased that all of that has brought D.A. Pennybaker back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
About that opening scene, the Subterranean Homesick Blues video with the cue cards, who came up with the idea?
That was Dylan's idea in a bar, and I'm happy. he said to me, I guess he was meeting me as the filmmaker, right? Because Albert had arranged for me to be considered as a filmmaker
for
the tour.
This is Albert Grossman.
Yeah, Albert Grossman. And he said, "Do you think that's a good idea for a film?" And I said, "It's a fantastic idea." So we loaded up about 100 shirt cardboards and took them to London with us.
And then you shot three different versions of it.
Well, we did, but we didn't intend to have three. The first one was out in the garden behind the hotel, and a policeman came up and kept hitting me on the shoulder to stop doing it, and we finally had to stop doing it. And then we did the one version that we used. We did it in the alleyway behind the hotel because we knew there weren't any cops there.
But also alleyways are in the lyric.
Right, that's right. And then we did one. Everybody was dressed up for something the next day, and they wanted to do another one with his producer. The guy was sleeping by the piano in the film, and we all got dressed up, and we went on the roof where it was very windy. And about halfway through it, I think the wind blew most of the cards away. So we only had one complete one.
You've said in interviews over the years that you don't make documentaries and that Don't Look Back isn't one. So how would you describe your films?
Well, I'm a little like Fred, I guess. I would tend to Fred Wiseman. I'd call them movies only because that's what I grew up learning, looking at. And I think when you get too secular about it, if you start thinking that this kind is different from that kind, you get into trouble because people will always fool you and do something different.
But your films don't include narration, and you've been quoted as being against all the labels that are attributed to filmmakers like you. You said various people began calling our films direct cinema. Others called it cinema verite, but nobody really knew what to call them. Some even called it fly on the wall, but that wasn't right. At least I never wanted to be a fly on the wall. It's kind of a disgusting idea.
Yeah.
So it's just movie making?
Well, you know, what I really think, Elias Leonard, is that what we have here is the beginning of a new language, which theoretically only children invent new language because their parents all have one already. And we're like children in the face of this technology, which allows us to practically speak, you know, and be heard. Well, it's like the whole thing that's coming out about particles, where you can have a particle, two particles, and you separate them by a million miles. And when you change one of them, it changes the other. So we're beginning to have a post-Einstein concept of what the world really is around us. And I think the need to tell people something is going to go beyond the just writing it out in a book.
So maybe you should call this quantum mechanics filmmaking.
Maybe. I don't know. Listen, when I use those words around my house, people start hitting me with brooms.
How much creative control were you given when you made arrangements to make it? You say it was...
Yeah. Albert just came.
Albert Grossman came
to you. He came in one time at lunchtime. Well, what happened was he came into our little office, which was on 43rd Street. We had Durst's building before he tore it down and built a new one. And... Ricky Leacock, my partner, was there, and
you'd already made a number of films.
I had made, it's hard. I can't remember when I made films, but I definitely was not what I would call a well-known filmmaker at that point. And I had made a little short film with Duke Ellington done the music, and apparently Dylan had seen that film. I forget why it's somebody had given it to him, but when he said to Ricky Leacock, he said, "Would you be interested in coming to London with my client Bob Dylan and making a film?" And Ricky said, "Who's Bob Dylan?" So he said, "Maybe I better wait for your partner."
Well, he was already well known, but still not superstar.
He wasn't exactly. He had a song that was on the radio, and that's what I remember. The times they are changing, but I didn't know much about him. And when Albert asked me, my immediate reaction was, I'd love to do films about musicians. And I had done a couple, and I thought maybe that was my calling, was to make films about musicians.
Now, this is about a 1965 tour of the UK.
Yeah.
But it wasn't released until 67. Was it difficult for you to find a distributor?
It was next to impossible.
Despite the fact that Dylan was already a well-known artist at the time?
Those things don't always move the way you would think. Fame is a peculiar bug, you know. It goes one direction and doesn't stop. I think what happened to me was that I had this film, which is shot on 16 millimeter and black and white, which is, if you would mention this to anybody working in Hollywood, they giggle because it's ridiculous. Nobody would make a film on 16 millimeter and black and white.
But you couldn't have shot this with the big 35 millimeter cameras of the time.
Well, you couldn't have shot it. You couldn't shot anything, we thought, because you needed portability. You needed to be able to climb up on stage or go out in the desert. But also, you needed sync camera, and there was no sync camera. You needed to have dialogue. And we had Ricky and I and Al Maisels had kind of worked on making a camera that you could carry, you could put on your shoulder, and that would be sync. And we had made it, but it still was kind of ratty looking. There was no question in my mind. And I took it to some people who were, I thought, in my naive notion, I mean, I was an engineer. I graduated as an engineer from Yale, and I'd say I knew less about this business than anybody in the world. And when we talked to people, well, would you like to run this film in your theater? What we realized was the people running the theater didn't really decide which films they were going to run. That was decided by somebody out in Los Angeles. All they decided was how much ice cream and popcorn to get in here to make their rent. And so we couldn't find anybody to run it or any distributor for it. And a guy called up one day and said, I understand you have a film that I ought to look at. And I was ready to show it to anybody at that point. And so he came over and he looked at it. In the end, he said, it's exactly what I'm looking for. It looks like a porn film, and it's not. And it turns out he had this huge group of pornographic film theaters all over the West. And he said, I'm going to give you my best theater. It's in San Francisco, and which he did. And we had a 16 print running there for almost a year.
And the title, Don't Look Back, works perfectly in a porn theater.
I know. That's right.
D.A. Pennybaker, we're talking about Don't Look Back, which Criterion has just reissued.
Oh, boy, they did such a great job. Criterion.
Some of these reissues, after they do all the work on them, the digital work, look better than the originals.
Oh, much better. Well, you've got to realize when we did it, I was taking you have a magazine which holds 400 feet of film, and you start out in the morning, a nice bright sunny morning, and you shoot everything at f64 or whatever it is. And at night you go into rooms which are not very well lit, and if you don't have lighting, we never light anything. We just, whatever is there. And that then you want to push that film, but it's the same roll of film, and you can only make it one speed. So we went to a lab in London, and they were terrific. They watched what they were doing somehow. I don't know how. And the result was the film is very unevenly exposed to be relatively clear to watch. And so we did the best we could when we made the 35 blow up, but it was at the time, we weren't using Hollywood techniques. We were using people in New York who would do it. And I think when Criterion took it up, they took the went back to the original negative and re-timed everything. And then they went in the track, they went to the back to the original quarter-inch tracks that we had, and actually made as good an ending of it as you could possibly make. And I'm really grateful to them. And Kim Hendricks is probably the person, along with Peter and the rest of the people over there, who really wanted to make the thing as good as they could.
Now, documentaries depend on what happens while they're being shot.
Yes.
And you really lucked out here. First of all,
can say that about my life. I really lucked out.
Well, I guess serendipity is an important part.
Essential to this kind
of
thing.
And in this case, you have Dylan becoming famous in England, having a real influence. He meets Donovan, who at that time was being accused of being a Dylan clone. You have the breakup of Dylan and Joan Baez as a couple.
Yeah.
And all sorts of other interesting, you catch some of these moments that perhaps Dylan wouldn't be all that happy knowing or going to wind up in a movie.
Well, it's interesting, people's reaction to themselves. I mean, it's the same with James Carville in The War Room. And he said, it's embarrassing, but I know that what you've shown is what really happened, and I can't go against it. And I think Dylan had somewhat the same attitude.
Now, we even have a scene where Dylan picks an argument with a reporter from Time magazine. He was distrustful of journalists?
Well, I knew that guy, and he later gave me the thing that he sent in. He gave me a copy of it. I still have it somewhere buried in a folder.
How well did you get to know Dylan at the time? Were you surprised? Because at this point, people thought he was very much of the left. Were you surprised when he wrote in Bob Dylan Chronicles, Volume 1, quote, I had a primitive way of looking at things, and I like country fair politics. My favorite politician was Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater.
Yeah. No,
Did you see that in him at the
well,
time?
I wasn't looking for political anguish. In fact, when I started the film, I thought Albert has asked me to do this film because he wants a musical film to help promote his whatever he's going to do besides his concert stuff, and the records maybe whatever. And but about 3 days after I spent time with Bob, and especially in the hotel when the press people who had been, who never knew who Dylan was at all were assigned to go get interview him. So they went having no idea who he was or what he was about. That I got intrigued by the way he used language. And a book that had always fascinated me long before I got into this was the book that was done in England about Byron and about his letters to and from Byron. And Byron, when he went to Pisa with Shelley, and all of the English intellectuals came down there to hang out. It was like San Francisco had turned into, with all the hippies. And I thought, if I'd been around then and made a film of Byron, people would still be looking at that film because he's still interesting to people. And I thought maybe that's the kind of film that's at stake here. And I shouldn't get involved with the music beyond hearing him sing. So I never had a complete song, I don't think.
Now, there are all sorts of extra features in this new box set from Criterion, including an interview with Patti Smith. How involved were you in putting those things together?
I didn't. They put that together out of the material. There's a lot of stuff. We shot a lot of things, and there's a wonderful thing of Marianne Faithfull singing with Joan. These are kind of things that were terrific. But the film I wanted to make, you got to understand, I made it in a viewer. I didn't even have an editing machine, and I did it very fast. I did it in 2 or 3 weeks, so I didn't spend a lot of time thinking all the other possibilities were there. I just wanted to see Dylan, the poet, trying to figure out if he was a poet.
And when it was released, it didn't receive a lot of positive press.
No, it didn't.
And now, of course, it's considered one of the great classics. And when you see other films that do something very similar, do you think I influenced a whole generation or many generations of people who do these kinds of movies. I don't want to say documentaries because you don't like that word.
No, it's all right. It doesn't matter what. It's not for me to decide what to call them. People call them what the hell they want to call them. You know.
And I'm not going to call you a fly on the wall anyway.
No, that's all right. A bug on the wall.
And your films seem to go back and forth between music and politics. There was the War Room.
Some do.
What's it like watching Hillary Clinton's presidential run 20-plus years since you and Chris Hegedus made the War Room?
There's a film there. I mean, anybody who cares passionately about what they do and wants to do that as well as they can all their life, that's education for anybody that's watching.
And I understand you're making a film now about a lawyer who's defending the rights of chimpanzees.
Yes.
So we'll have you back when that film comes out?
When the chimpanzees are happy.
You're going to have to come here not only with the lawyer, but with
being
one of the
chimpanzee.
Chimps.
We wanted to bring one into the courtroom when we filmed there. But, you know, we knew we had a favorable courtroom at the Supreme Court here on Center Street when the judge in charge of the halter allowed Chris, my partner, Chris Hegedus, to put a wireless mic on her. And I thought, I've never had a judge agree to do that. So she must want to be heard.
D.A. Pennebaker, his film Don't Look Back is about to celebrate it's celebrating its 48 years.
Is it 48 or 50?
Well, 50 years was a tour. 48 years was when the film came out.
I'm not too good on those dates, but I allow it. You look to you to figure the dates.
Available now in a new DVD and Blu-ray, digitally restored audio and video, and with special features, interviews, outtakes, and shorter documentaries from Criterion Collection. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate anybody who's interested in this kind of... in this kind of language, the language of filmmaking.
Any real estate broker will tell you that some of New York's most attractive housing stock is in the Bedford-Stuyvesant area of Brooklyn. One block, 135 years, the cover story of the November 16th issue of New York Magazine is by senior editor Genevieve Smith. Or are we saying, or Genevieve?
Genevieve?
Okay, well, I made you French for a moment.
Sounds great.
It focuses on McDonough Street between Malcolm X Boulevard and Patchen Avenue. And joining us now are Genevieve Smith and three of the 62 current and former people who've lived on McDonough Street and were interviewed for the piece. Ulrich Haynes Jr., who lived there from 1935 to 1948, became the U.S. ambassador to Algeria. Lynette Lewis Rogers, a resident of the block for over 50 years, and Brooke Vermillion, who bought her house about 5 years ago. Welcome all of you to our show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Genevieve, there are so many historic neighborhoods in New York. Why did you choose this specific block?
Well, there's a lot of blocks we could have chosen, but we wanted to do two things. We wanted to find a block that showed the epic change that's going on in Brooklyn. So we looked for a block where you'd seen lots of record house prices in the last few years, a lot of an influx of new residents. But we also wanted a block that had the deep roots that you mentioned in your introduction here, where there were people who'd been there for a very long time who could tell us a lot of the block's history.
And these days you have to do more than just write an article. This story really comes alive online, where you explore the neighborhood through video, pictures, and interviews.
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot of stories that try to get at how Brooklyn has changed, and we really wanted to get at the visceral experience of living in the neighborhood, and so we really let people's stories lead, and then we used our web presentation to help make the connections between neighbors obvious, and also to draw in a lot of the history.
Lynette, many of the interviews reveal a great sense of pride in the community on this block of McDonough Street. Is it all that different from some of the other well-known blocks in the area, like Lexington Avenue, Hart Street, Hancock Street?
I don't think there's that much difference. It's just that I think on McDonough Street there's such a history. There are so many people that are homeowners there that grew up there and are still living there. So
and you've lived there almost all your life?
It was the first house I came to when we came to the United States of America.
So your family moved there?
From the West Indies, yes.
And we'll get into the whole business of the West Indies and well, did you feel a closeness on the block when you were growing up?
Absolutely. We were joking outside earlier that there's nothing that you could do on the block or in the area that your family didn't know about, because there were people watching you. They were just the neighbors that were there really looked out for one another. So, yeah, there was a real sense of community on the block.
And there were, you say, neighborhood activities that brought people together.
Absolutely. We had a block association, which I think is the most prominent reason that people kind of came together. Everybody looked out for one another. We even had a junior block association.
Now, Genevieve, you started this story long before Lynette ever got there, 135 years ago.
I guess you could say that.
A few days.
Who was there then?
Well, you know, the block started out as farmland. It was owned by the Lefferts family, which, if you're familiar with Lefferts Gardens, they owned a lot of real estate in Brooklyn. And then they developed it at the turn of the century.
Brownstone
block. And the first residents after they built it in around 1899, 1900 is when most of the houses were built. The first residents were mostly Irish and German immigrant families.
And they decided not to build apartment houses, which were also being erected around that time?
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak to their real estate decisions and why they chose brownstones.
Ulrich, when did you move to McDonough Street?
Oh, I would say 1935.
Do you remember your neighbors and the other people on the street?
Vividly.
Did you have many friends?
Yes. My best friend was in the brownstone next door. He was of Irish background, Charles Doherty.
And when did you first notice that the demographics of Bed-Stuy were changing?
Oh, they were changing. We represented the change when we moved in. There were very few residents of color when we moved in. They were mostly German and Irish.
And you say that there was a great deal of hostility between black Americans from the South and the ones from the West Indies?
Not a great deal, but there was hostility. The African Americans from the South didn't like the West Indian accents. We didn't talk like them. We didn't eat like them. We were mostly Anglicans or Episcopalians, and if they had a religion, it was mostly Baptist. There was a great deal of cultural difference.
And Lynette, were you aware of that?
Somewhat.
You've lost that accent. You don't accent the wrong syllable anymore.
Well, oddly enough, I mean, when we first came here, the dialect of the country where I was born is Aruba, and we really speak Papiamento, which is a mixture of Spanish and Dutch. But my mother would not allow us to speak that in the house. And because my parents were both from a British island, St. Vincent, we had the King's English in the house. So we had to speak not just English, but the King's English. So our accent was even more pronounced in English than it was in West Indian dialect.
Brooke, you've only been in the neighborhood for a little over 5 years. Where were you from?
6 years, actually. Originally, I'm from Northern California, but I had been away. I moved to New York in 1996. And lived here for about 7 years, and then moved to Berlin and London for 8 years, and just moved back 6 years ago.
And you say that the block had a small town feel when you first visited, and
yeah,
that was a revelation.
It really was.
What did you think Bedford-Stuyvesant would be like?
Well, not that it was that I had any preconceived notion of how the community in Bed-Stuy would be. It was that I just didn't know that existed in New York. This kind of fantasy Brooklyn from the movies actually existed, and it was very different from the small town in which I had grown up, which I never felt comfortable in and was never excited to be in and didn't connect with the people. But this was like, oh, look, everyone says hi to each other and the kids play in the yard, but yeah, they're these sophisticated New Yorkers who, you know, are smart and interesting and I want to be friends with as well. So it was that combination.
Ulrich, was it like that when you were living there in the late 30s, early 40s?
Oh, no, it was in the late 30s and early 40s, it was predominantly the descendants of the original owners. So it was heavily German and Irish, and most of the merchants were Jewish. The grocery store owner, the candy store owner, the only Asian in our community was the Asian man who owned the local laundry. And I remember very, very vividly his son, a Chinese, was in elementary school with me, and he committed suicide because he was teased because of his race. And that was a very sad, sad event for all of us who knew him and for the community as a whole.
Genevieve, there's a graph in the story that shows a steep drop-off in white population starting around 1940. Was that because of government policy?
Sure, right. I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of explanations for a change like that, but probably the predominant one was after the New Deal, in an effort to kind of steer banks towards safe investments, the government actually created a map of, they split up Brooklyn by the safe places to invest and the unsafe. And Bed-Stuy was given the absolute lowest grading. And it made it impossible for homeowners in that area to sell their homes because no one could get a loan to buy them. It made it impossible to buy a home.
It led to what they call redlining.
Exactly. It's the and you look at the map and that area is red. It's literally redlining.
But why was it considered the safest, the least safe to invested?
Well, there are two reasons. One is that at that time, they were considered old houses. They were Victorian houses. They weren't modern. One of the things that they looked at was that, you know, these houses were out of fashion. The other thing was because there were African Americans living in the neighborhood. It was a fundamentally racist policy, and they thought that that would bring down the value of the homes.
So should we assume that other neighborhoods that became predominantly African American were also redlined?
I don't want to make any universal. I mean, we did a lot of history, a lot of research on this one, on Bed-Stuy, but certainly there are other neighborhoods in Brooklyn that were also redlined.
Ulrich, why did the white residents leave as a result, but not the black ones? They must have known that their property value was going down as well.
Well, as the property value went down, they became affordable to lower middle class and middle class African Americans. So it became a very desirable area for middle class and lower middle class Americans.
And one thing, you know, one thing to interject, like that they created a fantastic community in the midst of that. I mean, it wasn't only, you know, it was desirable for them to own homes, and they were able to, as Lynette talks about with her childhood and with the people that she grew up with, they had a really vibrant community within that.
But Lynette, one of your friends, Eileen Shea, moved out of the neighborhood.
Yes.
Do you think it was totally based on the fact that the neighborhood was predominantly black?
Well, no. Actually, her family actually grew up, I believe it's in the Bushwick area of Brooklyn. And she was just really going back to where her family was. They were there at her grandmother's home. So it was actually her grandmother that had bought the home and was living there, was aging out. They came there. Her mother and her brother and herself came there to really help out with her mother, but their roots were really back in the Bushwick, I think, Greenpoint area of Brooklyn, actually Greenpoint.
Brooke, when you moved into your house, some people had been on the block for 30 to 40 years. Did it take a while for people to warm up to you?
No, absolutely not. Only one person did I really have to earn it with, and that was Frenchie. And of course... and I was, it was so worth it.
You know Frenchie, Lynette.
Yeah, and I was willing to do it. I mean...
was worth it in the end.
Oh, it was so worth it. It really took me many months of, yeah, you know.
But so Frenchie's a character, character on this block?
Not so much famous. It's just his personality. He's just a bit, you know, cautious and standoffish.
Yeah.
And not.
I had a very different experience. The most of the white families on McDonough Street when we moved in had nothing to do with us. We did not socialize. At best, we acknowledged each other's existence by speaking when we passed in the street. But for example, my next door neighbors who were Irish, the McQuinn family, told their daughters, they had three daughters, and they told them that they were not to speak to us. And on one occasion, Mrs. McQuinn, I was playing in the backyard, and they had a German Shepherd dog, and the dog kept barking at me and running up and down the fence, and somewhat frightening me, certainly intimidating me. And my mother came out and asked Mrs. McQuinn if she could take the dog inside while I played outside. And Mrs. McQuinn said to my mother, well, she would not do that because her dog was better than my mother's son.
Whoa.
You know how that
is. That why your family, your family rented? So did you just leave because you felt unwelcome?
Did what?
Did you leave because you felt unwelcome, your family?
Not at all. They left because they did not they did not want to live next to a black family.
And they took their dog with them.
They took their dog with them. The exception was my friend who rented in their house, Charlie Doherty, who was also Irish-American. And he and I used to get out on the fire escape in the back of the house and not only talk, but we both collected those little turtles, and we used to discuss the state of affairs and, between our respective turtles.
I guess that's what got you into diplomacy later in your life. But why did your family leave?
Well, as my parents were able to afford a house of their own, they moved into a brownstone in Clinton Hill, not far from Pratt Institute, a lovely old brownstone. One of the things that I must say about all those houses is that the interiors, which were done in the 1890s, retained their elegance. So they were very elegant places with lovely woodwork, sometimes Tiffany-style windows. There was nothing run down or slum-like about McDonough Street or, for that matter, Clinton Hill.
And we'll return to that. We have to take a little break, unfortunately, but we'll return to that and why suddenly the real estate prices have rocketed in this neighborhood, partly, I'm sure, because a lot of these houses still look quite wonderful. But we're talking with Ulrich Haynes Jr., Brooke Vermillion, Lynette Lewis Rogers, and Genevieve Smith, whose article, One Block, 135 Years, is in the February 16th issue of New York Magazine.
November.
Why did I say February? I don't know. But anyway, it's in the November 16th issue of New York Magazine. We'll be back right after this. And we are back with Ulrich Haynes Jr., Lynette Lewis Rogers, and Brooke Vermillion. We are talking about a block that is the subject of a feature story, the cover story, in the November 16th issue of New York Magazine, One Block, 135 Years. The writer of that story is an editor at New York, senior editor Genevieve Smith. And Genevieve, haven't many of the one-family houses in the Bed-Stuy area been broken up into small apartments?
I think that's certainly the case. There are certainly at least one house that we know of on this block that had been really used as a boarding house for a while before it was recently bought.
Are there still many renters on the block, Lynette?
There are some renters. I think most of the homes, if not necessarily on McDonough Street, but in Bed-Stuy, are still lived in by their actual owners with some rental. Mm-hmm.
Well, I know a friend who was interested in buying a house there, and he was concerned that If he bought it, he was going to be throwing a number of people out of their rental units, and then he was going to have to live with his neighbors who were their friends. Was that something that concerned you, Brooke, when you bought your house?
No, because it was just a single family. I mean, it's broken up into two families, but only one person was living there when we bought the home. So we didn't have tenants, and now I have a couple of friends living on the third floor.
And did you, I'm sure that when you first thought of buying a house on the block, all those stories about Bed-Stuy, everybody warned you about Bed-Stuy.
Well, I knew that taxi drivers didn't want to drive through Bed-Stuy from having lived in New York for so long. But I also, you know, I was in the mid-90s when I moved here, everything was dangerous. And I knew that, you know, it just took Bed-Stuy maybe a little bit longer to catch up. But I didn't feel unsafe in
any way. And some of the local residents are complaining about gentrification. Genevieve, one woman says that older people are moving out because they feel that they have to. They can't afford the area anymore.
Well, there's a couple things. Some older people are, this is their retirement.
Yeah.
Their parents or their grandparents bought this house for $10,000. They're selling it for $1.5 million. They're moving to Florida, and that's the rest of their retirement. That's a great deal. So I think when you think about these issues, on every one of them, it's way more complicated than the trend piece you usually get. There are people who are impacted negatively, who feel forced out, feel like they can't afford, especially if they're a renter, they feel insecure. And then there are people who, this is the greatest day that's ever happened.
Lynette, a few people talk about block people versus avenue people. What do they mean by that?
Well, the block people, I guess the people that live on McDonough Street itself or on the inside blocks like that are more cohesive, much more of a neighborhood. The avenue is more commercial.
Like Bedford Avenue. And
yeah, the avenue is actually more commercial. There may be apartment buildings mm-hmm. on top of stores or restaurants or something. So it's more commercial on the avenue, and the block is really a majority of single and double family homes.
In the article, Genevieve, you write the surrounding areas succumb to crime, but this block remained a safe haven.
Sure. And when I say that, you know, we're not talking specifically about the crime, where the crimes occurred, but it was true that the, you know, in the stories that we collected from people, everyone talked about how you looked out for each other. And, you know, there's a couple guys even now who hang out on the stoop every day. And if
More
you didn't live
two.
In that block.
Brother Doc and June.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
If you walked on that block and you didn't know, you weren't from that block, you'd probably be like, what are these guys doing out on the stoop? But for everyone, so many people in their stories said how safe they felt having these guys there because they know that they're watching. And there's even, Brother even has a story about how they stopped a crime.
Yeah.
He and his cousin cornered a guy till the police could get there. So they really did look out for each other on the block because they know their neighbors and they say hello to their neighbors.
When I was working and I would sometimes come home very late at night, and in the morning when I was leaving, Brother would be saying, I saw you come home at 10 o'clock last night. I saw you.
Oh, yeah.
I was watching you. You know, so it's kind of comforting to know that you are being looked out for.
Ulrich, in your interview, you talked about being surrounded by black achievers. Did that have an influence on the black children in the neighborhood?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we were all expected to do well at school. Now, remember the elementary school that we all went to was at the end of the block. It was public school 70, and when in the 1930s and 40s, well, 1930s when I went to elementary school, there were no black elementary school teachers. All of our elementary school teachers were white. And our principal, Mr. Honekamp, was of German background. And we were treated no differently than the white students who were there. We were expected to do as well as they were.
And you point out that the black kids were more likely to go into college than the white kids at that time.
That's true. That's true.
And you went to Amherst in Massachusetts?
I went to Amherst. Two of my neighbors went to Mount Holyoke and Smith Colleges. Many of them went to Hunter College and CCNY and Brooklyn College. It was just expected that we were going to go to college.
But when you went to Amherst, you were one of only two black students.
At Amherst?
Yes.
in my class. There was rigid segregation even at the Ivy League schools. And at Amherst, only two black students were admitted in each class. So theoretically, there were eight of us among 800 students at the school when I was there.
How long after Amherst did you become a diplomat? I've read that you even played a role in resolving the Iran hostage crisis.
Yes. I became a diplomat in 1977. I was appointed by Jimmy Carter as the American ambassador to Algeria. I had had quite an international professional experience with the United Nations, with the the National Security Council in the Kennedy Johnson administration. So I was a known factor. I was pretty well known among the diplomatic professionals.
Now, go ahead.
But it was a fascinating experience, and I must say that growing up on McDonough Street was a help because when I grew up it was a multi-ethnic community, and I developed an interest in people who were different from me and a comfort in living with them.
I want to get back to the cost of housing. You mentioned $1.5 million as a typical price, although there is a building on Hancock Street that's selling for $6 million, I gather. Who's buying these places? Are there a lot of people buying to just flip the houses and make a profit?
There's certainly some investment in flipping going on. It seems like from the people that we were able to talk to, even the people who are flipping tend to live in the houses in between. But certainly there's cases of people who bought the houses 5 years ago for $750, selling them this year for $1.5, $1.4.
Milton Miles says that he came upon some people trying to ghost sell a house.
Right.
What's that?
Well, there's a lot of scamming going on. Certainly, there are people who are there are a lot of predators when you've got older people, especially who own these homes, who don't necessarily know the value of their homes. In this particular case, in Milton's telling of it, he was a caretaker for a house where the owners were no longer living in the house, and people were trying to break in, clean it up, and sell it off without anybody knowing.
Now, Brooklyn Lynette, I'm assuming that people have come to you and offered to buy your house.
We get a lot of flyers every day.
Oh, yeah. Every day.
Every day.
Every day we get flyers, we get phone calls. Have had somebody call me, and of course they are ready to buy the house. I said, yeah, I'm ready to sell. What's your price, ma'am? I said, 12.5. They said, your house is not worth 12.5. I said, it's worth 12.5 to me. A lot of the resurgence, I think, of people buying homes and coming into Bed-Stuy, I think I have to speak about the brownstoners of Bed-Stuy that play a role in that. For the last 38 years, we've held one of our major activities as a house tour, where homeowners open their homes and have people come in and see the beauty of the home that's been retained.
And they tour your house?
And they've not toured my house, no, but they do tour. They've been tours on McDonough Street, both our block and other blocks on McDonough Street. Our slogan is Come On Home to Bed-Stuy, and that was originally done for the African-Americans that were in Bed-Stuy in the 60s and leaving because of the problems that were there, because of the drugs, because of the crime.
It must be said that very few African-American families, even today, can afford to pay $1.5 million for a brownstone on McDonough Street.
And people who work in public radio as well.
Well, that means the process of reverting to white ownership is one that is to be contended with. That's now, what's happening.
Now, the idea of ghost houses reminds me, Brooke, and we don't have very little time. One thing you touch on in your interview is that your house is haunted.
I think all the houses are haunted.
Oh, yes.
People talk about the ghosts.
I sound pretty crazy because I really went into it, but I don't think there's anyone on the block that would deny that their house was haunted.
Sure, there are spirits there. There are definitely spirits there.
Over 100-year-old house. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One couple says that they've started doing Airbnb instead of having renters, that it's extremely successful for them. Does that conflict with the people who don't want a constant stream of people coming in and out of the block?
I don't see it as a problem. We've kind of almost embraced the travelers that come through the block. You know, people are asking us questions. We're asking, oh, where are you from? You know, where are you coming from? And they're asking us what's in the neighborhood. Where should they go to eat? Where should they go to for entertainment? So it's not been a problem.
Now, Ulrich, earlier we heard that a lot of people are selling their houses and moving down to Florida. Were you a pioneer in that regard? You're already down there?
Well, no, not at all. The cost of living in New York City is not friendly to retired people.
Even if they were ambassador to Algeria?
Even if they were, oh, you don't make money by being an ambassador. Come on. Florida is full of former New Yorkers. Mostly retirees. So there's a pattern there. And we move here because there are no state taxes. The cost of living is a lot lower than in New York City.
And the weather is warm.
The weather is magnificent.
So, Lynette, are you about to sell your house and move to Florida?
No. I think that's a natural progression, though, when we talk about a turnover in people living and another set of people coming in. Some of it is that we have a couple right now that have just sold their home. They're downsizing. They live on the 3 floors. They want to live on 1 floor. They don't want to shovel snow anymore. That's a natural thing. There are others that need to cash out for various reasons, maybe to pay off bills or see themselves buying somewhere else. And there are people that just want to stay. I have no intention of leaving. As I said, 12.5 is my starting point, and it can only go up from there. But I do have family that I want
and
to send the house
thank
to.
You all so much for being on our show. It's been a real pleasure talking about One Block, 135 Years. Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.